welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, folks, if you wanted to see what it looks like when a player blacks out on the golf course, go ahead and rewatch what Aaron Rye did on the back nine at this PGA Championship. Incredible ball striking, incredible poise, incredible putting, and it led to a three-shot stunner at Aronimink. Rex, can you believe that back nine surge from first-time major champion Aaron Rye?
I mean, 6 under over his last 10 holes. That's really impressive on that golf course. We didn't see any separation at all over the course of 4 days. Well, I'll say 3.5 days because he finally did it on the second nine. And I think everybody was anticipating something very dramatic coming down the stretch. I think you and I both were bracing for a playoff. I'm doing the notes for our newsletter right now. And I went back to a quote that Kerry Haig, the chief championships officer, gave me a few weeks ago that he hopes for a playoff. I think he's probably the only person on property that hopes for a playoff. And the idea being is that they're very excited. There's a three-hole aggregate playoff at the PGA Championship. And I tend to agree, selfishly, I think everybody in the media, certainly you and I, in that category, probably don't look forward to it. But that's where the expectation was. Because, again, it was historic lack of separation.
I mean, you look at, I mean, it was crazy. Rex, there was 22 players were separated by 4 shots. 30 players were separated by 5. Of course there was going to be a playoff before, of course, Aaron Rye went nuclear.
And you didn't see it coming for a lot of different reasons. No. Because players, I think you touched on this on the Saturday Night Podcast, just pointing out that the one thing that allows players to separate, well, it's usually ball striking. And this golf course kind of mitigated that with the way the golf course was set up, with the way that the fairways, they're wide, but they're very hard to hit. So the long drivers aren't going to have an advantage. The way you could put pins on knobs, which is what Kerry Haig did pretty much all week long, you mitigated the approach shot advantage for a lot of different players. So it came down to a putting contest. And it's no shock what Aaron Rye was able to do this week. I mean, he hit the ball. I mean, ball striking wise, you said he was brilliant. I will say he was average. And he didn't have to be any better than that.
Ball striking, he was brilliant in the sense that he was tactical and precise. It wasn't necessarily a Scotty Scheffler-esque display where he was hitting everything inside 15 feet, but he was hitting the shots that he needed to, and he was shaping it with trajectory and shot shape. I think that was sort of the precision and the brilliance of Aaron Rye in this tournament.
Because you look at what Aaron Rye does well, and it's not necessarily putting, and it certainly isn't necessarily distance. He's well outside the top 100 on the PGA Tour in distance, and he's well outside the top 100 in putting. So this was very much an outlier, and I'm not trying to take anything away from him. I think that actually gives me more fortitude that what he accomplished was even that much more special, because I was just reading Rory McIlroy's transcripts. He is the nicest guy on the PGA Tour. By all accounts, he has no enemies. He's the one person on the PGA Tour that's never upset anyone, which in and of itself is an accomplishment. But if you look at it statistically, you didn't see this coming simply because he hasn't been putting well this season on the PGA Tour. He's not particularly long, but I think that's the key to this particular golf course. And I don't think it's a coincidence that his only other win on the PGA Tour just also happened to come on a kind of a quirky, short Donald Ross golf course.
Donald Ross golf course.
Yeah, at the Wyndham Championship. I think it fits his eye. And that isn't to be critical at all. I mean, there's plenty of guys on the PGA Tour that will tell you, look, I can compete at Hilton Head. I can compete at Colonial. Maybe Riviera if it's not a wet week. Like, there's plenty of players on the PGA Tour that realize they don't have the firepower to compete at, say, a Quail Hollow last week. But you put them on the right course and they have confidence. And that's exactly what happened with Aaron Rye in this situation.
I mean, there's so much to unpack there. I do want to put a pin in what you said about what Kerry Haig, hoping that there was going to be a playoff. It's interesting. Do you trying to set up a championship for fireworks and entertainment, or are you trying to identify the best golfer? We're going to get to the golf course. We're going to get to the setup later on in the show. And you're exactly right, Rex. And when we talked on the eve of the final round, and there were so many players who were separated by so few shots, we both made the argument that I think it was going to be beneficial for a lot of these unproven players in this position for the first time, because someone among that pack was going to go out and have the best round of their life. Someone in that pack was going to go out and shoot 3, 4, 5 under par and steal the golf tournament. It was a really, really tense final round. And I thought that it was that way for the first, I think, 10 or 11 holes. We were all seemingly waiting for someone to break out of the pack. You could have made an argument for 6 to 8 players at that point could have realistically won the golf tournament. I was very thankful that I was not writing a game story, because you would have had leads over and over again swapping out the main protagonists and trying to create a narrative that way. And then, Rex, Aaron Rye stole this golf tournament. And he did so in unbelievable fashion. You can go back to what happened on 9, the fact that he canned, what, a 45, 50-footer for eagle. I'm talking to his caddy afterward. That was really the jump start to have some momentum heading into the back round. But think about the clutch shots that Aaron Rye hit on the back 9 alone. And I'm going to rattle them off here in quick succession. Remember 10, he missed short and right of the green. Somehow got up and down from par for a spot that should have been dead. On 11, he was one of just four players in the top 25 on the leaderboard who was able to make a birdie on that short par four. It was downwind, really hard to control your wedge shot. Aaron Rye did so, stuffing it inside 10 feet there. On 13, probably the shot of the championship for him, at least that was not a putt. Remember the long putt on 9. We're going to get to the long putt on 17 as well. But the up and down, about a 40-yard bunker shot off an upslope on 13, the drivable par four. His caddy said he had never seen Aaron Rye hit a golf shot that way, that spectacularly in that moment to that pin that was tucked. A huge birdie there to jump ahead. We saw Rory, we saw Rom, we saw a number of players unable to get up and down around that green and sort of stalled their momentum. On 15, a very strong two-putt par on a hole 540 yards that, again, to your point about the length, would not necessarily suit him. On 16, hugged the left side of the fairway with a left-to-right shot shape, with a left-to-right fairway that's canting from left to right, with the wind going left to right as well, ends up holding it in the fairway, and then is able to carve a 5-iron to about 20 feet to set up a two-putt birdie. Brilliant shots, both the tee shot and the approach shot. On 17, does what he has to do, hit the middle of the green, makes a 65-footer there. And then 18, spectacular. Splits the fairway, hits it about 12 feet, and cozies up the birdie putt to make par and shoot a 5-under 65. It was not a flawless round of golf. He was a little bit skittish over the first 8 holes. It was obviously built on the strength of some really long putts. But Rex, the shots that I just rattled off there, the precision, the quality, the shot making, the shot quality, it's as good as you're going to see in a major championship, regardless of the player who's striking it.
And we're going to talk around this a little bit during this podcast. I know we will. You mentioned that we're going to address the golf course, and I think there are some things that need to be addressed on that front. But I don't think you can skip past the idea that you're absolutely right, that Aaron Rye executed the brilliant golf shots coming down the stretch when no one else could. And when I say no one else, let's do the royal no one else. That's Rory McIlroy. That's John Rahm. That's Xander Schauffele. That's Cam Smith. You can keep Scottie Scheffler. The world's best players couldn't do what he did coming down the stretch. You cannot ignore that. We can sit and talk about the golf course. We can sit and talk about exactly what Kerry Haig was trying to do, who he was trying to identify with this particular setup. But you're absolutely right. Everyone else had the exact same opportunities, and no one else was able to do it except for Aaron Rye. I also want to just go back. I don't want to get the whole origin story here, but for those who are interested, I strongly recommend doing a Google search Monday morning when you wake up to find out who is Aaron Rye, because his story is absolutely amazing. Grew up working class parents in England. Parents didn't play golf. They played tennis. They thought maybe golf would be best for him. Really just kind of came about it organically. This is not the way superstars are born in this game normally. I mean, he kind of came up playing a 9-hole golf course, needed to learn the game through his dad would read books, and that's the way he figured it out. I love the idea that he turned pro when he was 17 years old, admits now that I wasn't ready to turn pro, just gave it a shot. It played what would be, I don't know how to describe this, maybe single A golf in Europe to kind of work his way up, lost his car twice. And I love the idea that when you talk to players who have been around Aaron Rye for a number of years, they say that point blank, he just gets better every year. It's the ultimate 1%, where he admits it himself. When he started playing in that single A league in Europe, he realized, I'm not long enough. I'm not smart enough. I don't make enough putts. I have to get better. And he's done that every single year. His path to the PGA Tour is really different than what we've seen, certainly from a major champion, but even just a PGA Tour player, period.
And look, it's a testament to his work ethic, his determination, his dedication. Xander Schauffele spoke about this on Sunday night. He thought that he worked hard. He thought that he put the time on the range and on the practice putting green in the gym. It seems like Aaron Rye is always outworking Xander. And so kudos to him for doing so. We're going to have a lot more about this in the newsletter. And that's a friendly reminder. Go to golfchannel.com/Rex and Lab to sign up for the newsletter. It'll be dropping on Monday morning. But I talked to Aaron Rye's wife for a long time on the 18th green. And she told me that Aaron Rye actually had a Scottie Scheffler moment from a couple years ago. Remember before Scottie Scheffler won his first Masters, he was in the fetal position. We've had a lot of fun talking about this over the years. Just basically saying, I don't know if I'm ready for all that's going to come with being world number one and winning a major championship and essentially launching your own star. This was a reduced version of that, but Aaron Rye was two shots behind heading in to the final round of this PGA championship. He and his wife were heading back to the hotel. They stopped in the car and they just talked for about a half hour. And it was Aaron Rye who was admitting that he had a fear that things were going to change too much in his life if he had success. And he went out and won the PGA championship. And his wife, who was also a professional golfer, a great player in her own right, that was like mind-boggling to her. Like, how can you be scared of being too good? But that's Aaron Rye. That is who Aaron Rye has always been. He has always been this understated, under the radar, doesn't want attention. He's never sort of outwardly expressed his goals. He never wanted to win major championships. He's never talked about wanting to win PGA Tour events. He's never had a number in mind. It never felt like winning major championships was going to be his birthright. He has always just been obsessed with the pursuit and the love of the game. That is what has driven him his entire career. It wasn't some outsized goals and expectations. He loves being a professional and he loves grinding. That's sort of hearkening back to his parents' upbringing in the working class, his parents sacrificing so much for him. We all know the stories about the iron covers and the two gloves and why he does it as sort of an honor and a tribute to his parents and what he's gone through. At the end of that conversation, and he was saying, look, I don't know if I'm ready for all that that's going to be thrust upon me if I win this tournament. He says, don't worry, I'm going to keep you grounded. You are one of the most kindest, most gentlest, most humble, most grounded human beings possible. If it feels like life is crashing on you and you're all the fame and all the attention, don't worry. I'm here and I'm going to make sure you don't get too big for your britches. I love that.
And I love the idea that the PGA champion admitted at the very end of his press conference tonight when he was asked about when you and your wife compete, because she is a top level professional as well. How do those matches work out? And he goes, I play TPC Sawgrass more than her, so I probably understand the golf course a little bit better. It gives me an advantage. And then finally he comes around to, yes, she beats me more often than I beat her, which is absolutely amazing to hear a conversation like that. And you're right. I remember speaking with Aaron when he first came on the PGA Tour. It was at the RSM Classic. He'd earn his tour card via the Korn Ferry Tour. I kind of make it a point to try to get to know the players that I've never really met before. And walking away thinking to myself that, yeah, he's not a PGA Tour member. Because all of them have something in the DNA that connects them all. Even Scottie Scheffler, who I would argue is right there in the same vein as Aaron Rye when it comes to just being a good person, being a good father, being a good husband, all of the things that we're talking about with Aaron Rye. But even when you talk to Scottie Scheffler, even when you spoke with him when he was still at Texas, there was still the edge. PGA Tour players always have some sort of edge that you have to. You cannot achieve what these players have achieved in their career, just making it to the PGA Tour.
They're inherently selfish and
inherently selfish, and they want to play the let me show you game. Let me show you what I can do game. It's written into their DNA that they want to prove to you and they want to show off in every particular situation that they have the opportunity to. And he had none of that. It was none of the bravado that you would think of a young player coming over to the United States to play, that I just want to be able to go out and win on the PGA Tour. Playing the Ryder Cup, we were having this conversation with our colleague Todd Lewis on the drive home tonight. He was joking with our colleague Paul McGinley that get ready for Aaron Rye on next year's Ryder Cup team at Adair Manor. And it's amazing, but it's not out of the realm of possibility because you consider what he's already done. He's won three times on the DP World Tour. Now he has won a major and won twice on the PGA Tour. He just gets better. It's what he did this week. He got better with every single round. And it seems like every year of his career, he just gets better.
I mean, this is another example of just how shy and understated Aaron Rye is. A couple years ago, we were at the Genesis Invitational, the tournament, obviously, that Tiger Woods hosts at Riviera. And Tiger was playing in the Pro-Am. And I was walking alongside Aaron Rye. And I was like, you know, he didn't have a tee time in the Pro-Am. And I was like, you ever met Tiger before? He goes, Oh no. I can't go out and introduce myself. I said, we're going to make this happen. Went up to Rob McNamara, Tiger Woods' manager. And I said, look, this is Aaron Rye. He's playing in the golf tournament. Huge Tiger Woods fan. Obviously he grew up idolizing him. We talked about that on Sunday night as well. Would love the opportunity to meet him. Walks right up to him. They had a couple words, and it was a great experience for him. He would have never gone out of his way ordinarily to go up to introduce Tiger. He was merely content walking alongside Tiger Woods in the Pro-Am and just soaking up the aura. If you're not a fan of Aaron Rye, if you don't like Aaron Rye, I don't know what to tell you. You are not a good person. He is one of the kindest, most gentlest professional athletes you will ever meet. I also, Rex, sitting back here now at the end of the PGA Championship as it relates to Aaron Rye, I have the same feeling that I had after JJ Spawn. And I think if you're a casual sports fan, if you're a casual golf fan, you may not have been brought in by Aaron Rye's style of play or what Aaron Rye did at the PGA Championship, or really this tournament in general on Sunday. I had the same feeling, though, last year at the U.S. Open with JJ Spawn. You had a bunch of big names who were trying to hunt him down. Scottie Scheffler was in the mix. John Rahm was in the mix. Terrell Hatton has become a little bit of a fan favorite because of his on-course antics as well. And it was JJ Spawn who won the golf tournament. JJ Spawn went out and won. And the shots that he hit on 17 and 18 last year at Oakmont in particular were spectacular. And it made you feel good at the end of the tournament. Like, this guy went out and won. The way that Aaron Rye played this back nine at Aronimink, he saw an opportunity and he completely seized it with his shot making. I think everyone who is leaving Philadelphia on Sunday evening feels good about this champion and feels that it was deserved. How about some of the players, Rex, who did not get it done on PGA Championship Sunday? This could be actually fun that we could rank the players who are kicking themselves the most when they leave Philadelphia on Sunday night.
Well, reading Rory McIlroy's transcript, I'm going to start with Rory because he immediately went to, if I'd have played the par fives better and the drivable par four, which he ended up bogeying. So that's a two-stroke swing right there. That is essentially four strokes. And that isn't the difference in where he ended up finishing. Again, Aaron Rye kind of separated himself from the pack late in the round. But my guess is Rory is at the top of that list. Maybe a little bit of John Rahm, but I was in on John Rahm's press conference and I did not get the indication. I did not feel like he was trying to figure out what could I have done better. I think John Rahm felt like he played really well on this golf course. Yeah. I think every player walking off would tell you the same thing. Man, that was hard. Like they didn't see 65, 64, 63s out there. I think the best quote from John Rahm all week long was he spent Tuesday and Wednesday trying to figure out what he was missing. Because people like you and I were talking about, well, no, 16 under is going to win. And he didn't see that at all. Turns out he was closer to being right than we were, because this golf course was a lot different than I think any of us anticipated. So I was
up on the live from desk on Tuesday and Wednesday with Aaron Oberholzer and Paige McKenzie. And we were using terms like massacred, desecrated, wedge-a-thon. Like, we thought that the place was going to get absolutely annihilated and obliterated, and it didn't. Now, there's certain reasons for that. We're going to get into that in the second segment, but it certainly did not play the way that we all thought. Going back to Rory a little bit, Rex, I would not put him on the top of my list for players who are kicking themselves the most. Certainly, he could have improved his par five play. I believe he was even par on the eight par fives for the week for the way that he drives the golf ball in particular, a little bit surprising. But look, he did the same thing at Augusta. He was able to get away with there with tidy wedge play. Not so from some of the gnarly lies that he found himself in the rough throughout the course of the week here at the PGA Championship. You think back to 13. Had just a 3-wood off the tee, could have put that anywhere around the front of the green, made that an easier up and down, and instead blows it way right, flubs the pitch, sticks it in the ground a little bit more, trying to be tentative with that hole location, ends up walking off with a bogey. Very disappointing for Roy McIlroy. I think the number one player, not necessarily who's kicking himself, Rex, but who is going to be feeling like I could have easily won this golf tournament, is John Rahm. And in my opinion, I thought it was a great week for Rombo. I thought he played spectacularly. Look at the way that he did on Sunday. That was the most fairways of the week, most greens of the week. He just took 33 putts and just couldn't quite get it unlocked. He couldn't quite take the lid off. He couldn't quite get some of the momentum. But I thought overall, he really comported himself well, especially considering everything that's been swirling around him and his future and LIV Golf over the past month. Had an incredibly disappointing performance at the Masters. For him to come back 1 month later, put everything that he said into practice in reality here at the PGA Championship, I thought it was a great week. He did not sound defensive. He gave a lot of great answers. He had a lot of good perspective. And it's great to see him playing great golf again, because this is a generationally great player who is taking a little bit of a dip over the past couple of years.
I think John Rahm is a fascinating case study this week, but I do not. I kind of disagree with you on that front. Like, again, listening to him, I don't think there was any regret. I don't feel like he was ruining anything. Yes, there was, and his words were, it was the difference was three strokes. And if you give me four rounds, I can go over those four rounds. And of course, I can find three strokes. We're golfers. We can always do that. But he felt like, man, I played really well, especially coming down the stretch. Could I have made a couple more putts? Absolutely. But to your point, I do think it is fascinating to look at where he is right now in his career. And it's been pretty clear that, you know, when the news came out last month that the Public Investment Fund was pulling away from LIV Golf at the end of this year, it is just limbo. It's chaos. It's uncertainty. And most golfers don't like that. But in a weird way, John Rahm has actually been freed up by it. He spoke about this last week in Virginia at the LIV event when he was sort of asked about the contract. And he's like, seems like it's a pretty lock solid contract. I don't know anything about contracts, but that one seems like I'm pretty much
don't see many ways out is the exact quote.
Yeah. Like I don't know, man. It seems like my plight is pretty clear over the next 3 or 4 years. In a weird way, I feel like that freed him up. And I do think it's interesting. He talked at the Masters and he did not play well at Augusta National. And this is his best finish at a major since joining LIV Golf. This would be, you and I kind of quibbled about this last night, this is the first time he's truly contended, in my mind, at a major championship since he joined LIV Golf in December of 2023.
He was tied for the lead last year at the PGA Championship. It's been back-to-back years at the PGA where had an opportunity, just couldn't quite get over the line.
He was 5 strokes back to start the final round. I'm not quite sure if I'd ever. I mean, I think
he was tied for the lead. He was tied for the lead on the back nine.
Tied for the lead on the back nine, but the leader, the eventual winner, had plenty of room to play in front of him. So I'm not buying that. I would argue this is the first time he's truly been in contention at a major championship since joining. And I also think there's something, and he touched on this at the Masters when he struggled there. He talked about I have figured out that maybe my major preparation isn't right. He didn't go into detail, and he didn't go into detail tonight when we asked him about it, but clearly he is still trying to figure this out because he came into this week with a clarity of thought. He claimed it came into this week with a confidence in his game that you haven't seen in a while. He's playing well on LIV Golf. You can't take anything away from that. But to pull that over into majors, I think that's what we've been waiting for since he joined LIV.
Yeah, I think he has to be among your top five favorites for the U.S. Open at Shinnecock, a tournament he's already won before, and a setup, I think, with the brutal nature of it, that should fit him quite well. A couple other players I think Rex could potentially be ruining what happened on Sunday. 54-hole leader Alex Smalley, even though it was the first time he'd ever been in that position, I thought he actually acquitted himself quite well, made a mess of 6. The short par 4, drove the ball, pulled it left, ended up making a double bogey in what should have been a birdie hole if he was able to find the fairway. That was certainly disappointing. Ended up rallying and tying for second, earning some very valuable FedEx Cup points for a player who at this point is having the best season of his career. You look at Matty Schmid, who was in the final group with Alex Smalley, still had an opportunity. He was just one shot behind at the time. On 15, it's playing easier. It's the 554-yard hole. We saw even Aaron Rye, short-hitting Aaron Rye, take 3 wood to make sure that he was going to put the ball in play. Matty Schmid takes driver, blows it right into the bunker, ends up making a bogey there to doom his chances. I mean, you could even look at Ludwig making 4 bogeys on the day, made 2 birdies in his last 3 holes to salvage what was otherwise a pretty soft effort. Cam Smith, I think, could have changed the narrative for that final round as well had he been able to leapfrog Justin Thomas, get into the house at 6 under par. Cam Smith, one of the best putters on the planet, missed 6 putts inside 20 feet on the back nine alone. I think if he's posting 6 or 7 under in the clubhouse, that back nine could have played out a little bit differently with everyone sort of chasing a target. And I think you could even point maybe a little bit further down the leaderboard. I think his chances were doomed on what happened on Saturday, but Scottie Scheffler and his putting inside 10 feet. Scottie Scheffler missed 14 putts, Rex, inside 10 feet over the course of the week at the PGA Championship. Compare that to Aaron Rye, who missed just 4. Aaron Rye missed just 4 putts inside 10 feet. That alone, Rex, is 10. 14 to 4. That is the difference in what happened with Scottie Scheffler and Aaron Rye. Scottie certainly hit it well enough to win this golf tournament.
And Justin Thomas, just to kind of clean that up, I mean, the final round 65, he's coming off of major surgery. And I think both you and I have been watching since he came back. I think it was at API, sort of intently waiting for him to play his way back into form. And we've seen that. He played well the week before at Quail Hollow.
that was a heck of a way for him to finish on a difficult golf course. I'm curious to see how long did he wait around? You think he waited around until maybe the birdie putt by Aaron Rye on 17? Is that when he was kind of like, all right, I can probably get on the plane now? And then the other person I did want to point out was Alex Smalley. And you're right, he didn't pull it off going into the final round with a two-stroke lead. Clearly, he's going to be disappointed, but he did accomplish quite a bit. First and foremost, he qualified for the U.S. Open. He's going to get inside the top 60 on Monday morning in the world rankings, so that gets him into that. Also gets him into next year's Masters. So you look at these little incremental victories for a player like Alex Smalley. I think this week was huge for him.
Yeah, a lot of fun on Major Championship Sunday here at the PGA Championship. After the break, we're going to dive a little bit deeper in some of the biggest stories and the biggest storylines that we were watching and what it means moving forward after the year's second major. It's coming up after this short break. All right, Rex, the year's second major is in the books. It feels like we've been in Philadelphia for about 3 months. Instead, it was just 1 week. It was a long week. It was a hectic week. It was an entertaining week. What do you think were some of the biggest storylines coming out of the PGA Championship?
Well, first and foremost, we touched on it. I don't think either one of us have seen that kind of parity at a major championship in my career. I don't think we've gone into the final round and you could have gone down a list of 20 players. And that's not even an exaggeration of, yeah, I could have made an argument for 20 different players going into Sunday's final round. So that was fun. I think the part that stands out to me, and we sort of touched on it earlier in the week, because they had this big debate on Live From about trees versus no trees, because they cleared out a lot of trees at Aronimink. And there was a lot of talk about the golf ball and the rollback and players hit it too far. And as a golf club like it, or as a golf course like Aronimink, is it just been passed by? Do modern athletes simply is it too much for them to handle modern?
It's 7,400 yards, which again is short by today's standards. It played about 7,100 yards in the final round, but it's still, at least on paper, it's still a pretty stout test, Rex.
And the winning score was 9 under par. Now, granted, it seems to me Kerry Haig was very, very creative with a lot of his hole locations, and he really probably pushed some of the limits of some of those hole locations, specifically on 11, talking with a lot of different players. I don't know if Aronimink has been outgrown by the game. That's not even the argument that I want to make, because maybe there's certain golf courses that, based on the modern game, they simply can't hold a major championship anymore. And I do understand when you talk to the historians and you talk to those who love these old courses and do not want to see the game move past a Marion or one of these classic golf clubs. I get that part of it. I don't know if it has or not. The part that I get hung up on, and you didn't like this conversation at all the other night, so I know you're not going to like it now. I don't understand why golf is taking their major events. This is one of golf's 4 or 5 Super Bowls based on the Ryder Cup as well. And we took it to a neighborhood. Would you like to know what the population is in Newtown Square?
15,000.
Not even close. It's 2,500 people live in Newtown Square. So it's essentially they're playing
the championship. The Open Championship takes every single year to these remote little towns.
And that's entirely different because they've been doing this now for generations. And you and I both know that when we show up at Birkdale, the parking's going to be fine. The trains are going to get people in there. You don't have the logistical issues that you end up with when you come to a Marion, when you come to a Aronimink. I keep going down the list on and on and on. It seems to me golf is still stuck in the idea that, yes, we have to go to these classic golf courses because that's what's best for the game. And I don't think that's right.
Venues. You should go. For a major championship, you should be going to the best courses, not the ones that can accommodate all of the huge infrastructure that it takes for a major championship. And if you can't have major championships at these venues, then something's wrong.
Exactly. You can't. That's the whole point of this. This is a business. I don't know what part of this you and everyone else doesn't understand. This is a big business. They don't hold the Super Bowl in Longwood, Florida. They don't hold the Super Bowl in Newtown Square, Pennsylvania. Nothing against Newtown Square, Pennsylvania. It's a wonderful place. But it's a tiny little town that shouldn't be hosting a major sporting event. I continue to have this argument all along because we keep trying to shoehorn these events into these little tiny venues. And it doesn't work anymore. These are big events. These are money-making events. You need to make the most of them.
I don't understand what wasn't working. I didn't have any logistical issues all week. I didn't hear about any logistical issues all week. The Philadelphians turned out en masse. Tens of thousands of people were lining the fairways. I thought it was a really spirited atmosphere throughout the course. If you're talking about the golf course and whether it can stand up to today's
that's not what I'm talking about. I think that's a different conversation. No, that's not what I'm having. I'm talking about logistically, and it was scaled back.
You didn't have as many people here on property. I don't know what the ticket difference is, but I talked to Kerry Haig about it. There were dramatically fewer tickets sold to this PGA Championship than were sold last year at Quail Hollow, which is a major championship venue. They can handle a major sporting event. That's my argument, that in golf, we seem stuck in the past when it comes to so many different things. And a lot of those things I'm perfectly fine with. I love going back to the old course. And I would argue that if I was going to build a city specifically to host a major championship, it would look just like St. Andrews because they have the logistics figured out there. It makes no sense to me to try to shoehorn a major sporting event into a little tiny venue just because historically that's what we've always done.
So if you're using this argument, then you're really not going to like next month's U.S. Open at Shinnecock, where Mike Wan, the CEO of USJ, has already said that they're going to be reducing the number of people they could have on site because you're going to have a two-lane road going in and out to try to get to Southampton for the U.S. Open at Shinnecock. Are you saying that the modern game and the modern infrastructure for a major championship has also outgrown Shinnecock, which is a top 10 golf course in the United States?
I don't think so. And I guess I'll have to wait to get there next month and see. And I guess it depends on how many
people. It's going to be a mess.
It could be. And like I've covered a U.S. Open at Shinnecock, and I know logistically it's really bad. So I guess I'll take my answer back and say yes. That's what I'm going to go with. And
these are the cathedrals of the sport. To quote John Bodenhammer, these are the cathedrals of the sport. And all of a sudden, you don't want to take them to them because it doesn't meet the modern requirements for what a major championship should be. I think we should be scaling a major championship through these venues, not vice versa.
Now, Yankee Stadium used to be a cathedral in baseball. And you can say, well, they still play at Yankee Stadium. No, they don't. They played at the big Yankee Stadium they built next to the cathedral that got too small. Does that make sense? You see what I'm saying there? Connecting the dots there? Every sport grows. And in golf, there is this reluctance to grow with what you need to do because this is a big business. And what you're doing is you're strangling yourself. Yes, I love Shinnecock. It's an unbelievable golf course. I actually loved walking around Aronimink. I think it's a really cool track. You and I both commented that from the members' tees, I bet you this place is a lot of fun to play. I'm just looking at this practically. I'm looking at this from a business perspective. And it makes no sense to me that we continue to do this time and time again. Now, this being said, go back to last year at Oakmont for the U.S. Open. And Mike Wan, the CEO of the USGA, pointed this out. They have these anchor sites now. And the whole idea behind the anchor sites was, and we saw it last year at Oakmont, is you build out the infrastructure. So every time the U.S. Open goes back to Oakmont, it's a little bit better. There's more room. There's more parking. There's more chalets. There's more spectator viewing areas. It only gets better year in and year out. There's a reason why the Masters is the Masters, because they've been at the same venue for so long and they have absolutely perfected it. That's a major sporting event. This, not so much.
Well, you're going to be in hog heaven next year and also in 2034 when the PGA Championship goes to Frisco, because there's nothing but wide open spaces. The golf course, I think, leaves a lot to be desired. It is nothing. It pales in comparison to Aronimink, but sure, it's going to be wide open and you're going to have plenty. I can't believe this is a hill that you're worth. That you're willing to die on. And I can't wait for the comments in the YouTube comment section. You can obviously find Rex at Rex Hogger GC on social media as well. I thought you were going to turn this into a golf course and a setup conversation, which I didn't particularly care for either, because I think that's also related, Rex, to the overall point of the footprint and the footprint of the golf course. And if there actually was any sort of regulation on the equipment and the golf ball and scaling it back, or you're looking at the driver head and making it smaller and you're sort of putting an emphasis on hitting the center of the club face as opposed to off-center hits, or you're going to limit the driver shaft to reduce distance that way, then you would not have to have, I think, a golf course in Aronimink, which again tipped out at about 7,400 yards during the PGA Championship and was close to 7,100 yards in the final round, which is unheard of for a major championship in 2026. But I don't think it was necessarily tricked up, but I thought the PGA Championship staff, led by Kerry Haig, was very, very protective of the golf course. And everyone knew that Aronimink was short by today's standards. Everyone knew that players, if you could fly at 305 yards, you're going to be able to carry a bunch of the dog legs and carry a bunch of the bunkers. Everyone knew that Aronimink's greatest defense was its putting surfaces. They're notoriously difficult. They're diabolical. There's a lot of slopes, ridges, and humps. And I thought the PGA of America, over the first 54 holes in particular, were way too protective and they put way too many pins in treacherous spots. That is why you had so much of the bunch scoring, because there was very little separation of skill. Because when there wasn't a penalty for hitting it offline, which there wasn't over the first 54 holes, we're going to put a pin in that because Aaron Rye was very precise and he was rewarded for that in the final round. But when you did not have a penalty and the greens are so dangerous with any sort of misses, everyone is essentially playing from the same spot. Everyone is hitting it to 25, 30 feet and taking their chances from there and putting very conservatively, putting very tentatively, and putting very cautiously. I don't think it was any surprise when you look at the three previous tournaments that you had at Aronimink Golf Club. The winners, all of them were ranked inside the top three in strokes gained putting for the week. It became a putting contest because the golf course can get overwhelmed. This week in particular, four of the top six eventually on the leaderboard were all ranked inside the top five in putting, including Aaron Rye, whose numbers were obviously boosted by the bombs that he made in the final round. If you had a golf course that was playing more to size, if you did not have players who were able to fly at 350, 360, 370 because of the modern equipment, because of the agronomic conditions, because it was 85, 90 degrees over the weekend and the ball was flying forever, you could have had a test that did not need to be set up so protectively as the PGA of America did throughout the PGA Championship.
I think this was the test that Kerry Hague saw because he knew the alternative. The alternative was not setting it up on the edge, at least when it comes to hole locations. And we probably would have gotten closer to that 16, 17 under that you and I and AO and everyone else predicted that John Rahm absolutely didn't see. Although I don't even know if there's enough hole locations on those greens to set up that type of scoring now in retrospect, knowing what we do about it. And you're absolutely right. Like if you go down and break down the stats of when Keegan Bradley won here back in 2018 at the BMW Championship, or it was soft. However, it's pretty much the exact same formula that we saw out of Aaron Rye. It was sublime putting, it was hitting fairways, and it was decent approach play. And it was the exact same thing for Keegan Bradley in 2010 when he won the AT&T National. It identifies a very certain type of player. And this goes to, I think, the conversation that you wanted to have. Most major championships in the modern era right now, you're going to identify the best ball striker, whether if that's off the tee, or that's from the fairway, or some combination of those two things. Some places it's going to get rewarded that you just stand on tee boxes and just bomb away, and it's a Rory McIlroy type test where the longest and the straightest is going to win that week. Some weeks, most weeks, it feels like, Augusta National being the primary example, it's a second shot golf course, and you're going to award approach play and exacting and making sure you're hitting it to the exact spots you want to on those types of demanding greens. This is clearly a putting contest. I'll take it a step further and say it's a lag putting contest because yeah, you weren't giving yourself that many opportunities to really convert. 9 under par, one, and it won by 3 strokes. So it seems like Aaron Rye was in a category all by himself. I don't have a problem with that because it's simply a different part of the game to identify. You can sit here and make an argument that maybe Kerry Hague took it over the top and leaned into something that it shouldn't, but the last three champions have done the exact same thing. That's what this golf course identifies. And we can have the conversation about, did you identify the best player this week or the best player? And I would argue he probably just identified the best player this week.
Yeah. And look, I don't want every golf course setup to be homogenous. I think that's boring. When you look at what's the greatest indicator or predictor of success, it's typically iron play. And that was not bearing out. Ludvig Åberg was the best ball striker over the course of 54 holes, and he was not leading the golf tournament. Had it been any other setup, any other golf course, he probably would have been leading out front with Scottie Scheffler right on his heels. What I saw unfold in the final round, I think, is what Kerry Hague and company would have preferred over the first 72 holes, where you did have a differentiator in skill, and thus you had variance in the scoring. There was a premium on finding the fairways in the final round. In fact, Aaron Rye hit 10 of 14 fairways. He was tied for second in driving accuracy. That then allowed him to be a little bit more aggressive and take on some of the flags that his peers were blowing in the rough. And you and I joked that the ball was just diving into Mufftown, USA. It was sitting down. You weren't able to control it because, again, it was hot, it was firm, and you were unable to put enough spin on the golf ball to keep it on the greens. They just limited the number of birdie chances. Meanwhile, Aaron Rye was able to pick the shot he wanted and sort of strategically plod his way around. And when he had a good number, he could attack. When he had an off number or he was out of position, he had to play a little bit conservatively. That is why he won the golf tournament. That was why we saw the differentiation in scoring, where you had a 63 in the morning, You had a 65 from Justin Thomas. You had a 65 from Aaron Rye in the afternoon when everyone else was just getting by with 68s and 69s.
And I get what you're saying. I'm not going to say it dumbed down the ball striking, but to a certain degree, I think this setup, it does. It lends itself towards more of a putting contest. And again, I don't think it's a bad thing. You have plenty of opportunities where the best ball striker is going to be the player that emerges from this week. I would say Shinnecock is 100% going to be that. Last week at Quail Hollow, it was 100% going to be that. This was simply a different kind of test.
Yeah, ball striking is, if you think back to, remember 2018, the U.S. Open, Brooks Koepka there, like that was a plodding style of just bludgeoning it and hitting it to the center of the greens and two-putting it that way and just grinding out pars. I think everyone appreciates that because that takes ball striking excellence. This was a little bit fluky. This was a little bit funky. This was a little bit unpredictable in terms of the variance.
No, I don't like fluky putting. No, I don't like fluky. I don't like that as a describer because again,
long putting is fluky. The make percentage from 25 to 30 feet, which again is where most of these players were hitting it on the PGA Tour, somewhere between 2 and 5%. And if everyone's hitting it there, and Alex Smalley and Matty Schmidt are pouring in putts from that length, that is fluky. You're looking at just pure make percentages on the PGA Tour. It's fluky to make those sorts of putts.
Now it's fluky to make those putts. However, it's not fluky for.
Three-putt avoidance is a skill, and making putts in the 4 to 8 foot range is a skill. Yes. And through the first 54 holes, at least, they had one of the least number of make percentages on the PGA Tour this season from that particular range.
And approach putt performance. That was the one stat that I watched all week long. Because if you look at approach putt performance, and it's a little weird to try to describe that, but it almost mirrored the leaderboard perfectly. If you look at Aaron Rye, he was second in that category. Pretty much everyone else fell into the category that they were. Again, not the probably the test I want to see week in and week out on the PGA Tour or at a major championship, but it's just a different test. It's a different way to identify the top player in the world. And this one, just so turns out, was Aaron Rye.
Yeah, look, we don't want cookie cutter. We don't want homogenous. What you saw at the PGA Championship is different than what you see at the Masters. It's going to be different than what you see at the Open Championship and certainly next month at the U.S. Open. I know, Rex, you also wanted to get into LIV Golf and that being one of the biggest storylines of the week for you. You look at John Rahm's play. You look at Cam Smith's play. You look at Joaquin Neiman, who was chasing some of the leaders over the course of the tournament as well. What was the biggest takeaway on that front with the breakaway league, which, look, its future could not be more uncertain?
And they're in sell mode right now. Let's be honest. Scott O'Neill, the CEO of LIV Golf, has to go out and sell this league now. The Public Investment Fund is pulling the funding at the end of this year. So they have to find their version of SSG. That's, of course, the private equity that invested $1.5 billion into the PGA Tour. This only helps. It would have helped if one of the players won. Absolutely. If John Rahm would have won this, that would have been one more chip that Scott O'Neill has when he goes to these
Legion 13, $500 million, no doubt about
it. Exactly. Whatever the team is going for. I will say Cam Smith is interesting because he hadn't played well at all, and I think he'd missed his last five or six cuts in the major championships. I don't think he'd performed quite well at all, really, since he joined LIV Golf in the major. So I think this was an intriguing turnaround for a lot of those players coming into this. And I'll go back and say the same thing that I said about John Rahm. It seems like most of the players on LIV Golf have reached an epiphany and reached a point that, man, I don't know what the future is going to hold. Like at this point, there was a lot of confusion.
That's interesting. Do you think it's an epiphany, Rex, or do you think it's urgency and that now they're sort of seeing their competitive mortality on LIV Golf potentially approaching? All of a sudden, are they locking into it to a new level? I mean, Cam Smith has done virtually nothing on the world stage over the past couple of years. Obviously, he changed swing coaches, left his longtime swing coach, just started hooking up with Claude Harmon III over the past couple of weeks. But this, I think you see a level of clarity and sharpness in the play that was not evident for either John Rahm or Cam Smith.
Which I think there's a good point to that. However, the outlier, of course, the outlier is always Bryson DeChambeau, where he doesn't seem to have anything going right in his game right now. You looked at him on the range early in the week. I was talking with some reps on the range. They're like, he is in full grind mode. Like it seems like everything that's going on right now in that circle is panicky. He didn't play well. He missed the cut by a million, didn't talk to the media. So the world is not all right with Bryson DeChambeau. And I would say the immediate future leans more towards Bryson DeChambeau. We know his contract is up at the end of this year. John Rahm is in it for the next couple of years. He said as much. Like, there's nothing I can do about this. My guess, Cam Smith is in a very similar situation. Dustin Johnson, who hadn't done anything in the major championships in quite a while, played well. He actually surfaced, showed something that we haven't seen from Dustin Johnson. He's in the middle of a long-term contract with Liv Goff. So yes, I think there is something inside them that probably sees a future beyond Liv Goff, is probably a fair way of saying it, trying to figure out what's next. And maybe a better way of saying it is a future beyond the public investment fund, because we don't know. Maybe Scott O'Neill does come up with some sort of funding and maybe they do carry on. So I think those are the questions that are probably driving these players right now.
Yeah, look, those are two different buckets, right? With John Rahm and his competitive future and Bryson DeChambeau, who is going to be a free agent at the end of 2026. I touched on Bryson DeChambeau in the newsletter that dropped on Saturday morning. There's so many unanswered questions. And again, we had a lot of questions for Bryson DeChambeau and didn't have an opportunity to ask or hear any answers. He declined to talk to the media both after his opening round as well as on Friday. It's the first time since 2017 that he has missed two major cuts in the same season. You'd love to know, why is he so lost? Why is his driver no longer a weapon? Is he dealing with shoulder and wrist issues that he's talked about over the past couple of months? Why is his approach play and his wedge play in particular fallen off since 2020 or 2024 when he last won a major championship? Why has his putting suffered in major championships as opposed to live tournaments? A whole lot of questions as it relates to Bryson DeChambeau. All right, after this short break, we are going to have our final thoughts for Ronrick Golf Club, which Rex apparently cannot wait to leave. Apologies to all of our friends at Newtown Square.
Love it here. It's not true. I love it here. That's not true.
All right, Rex, our bags are packed. We're about to head back to Florida, but first, we're halfway through the major championship season. We just covered the PGA Championship, a lot to digest over the past 7 days. What are some of your final thoughts as we look forward to the U.S. Open and the year's third major?
You caught me flat-footed like 2 or 3 weeks ago when you asked me the player of the year, and I had to really think that one through. And when you sit and you think about what Matt Fitzpatrick has done, you look at what Chris Gatterob has done, you look at Rory McIlroy, you keep going on and on down the list.
Cameron Young.
Yeah, there's plenty of players who have performed, but Rory is going to stand out because right now, halfway through the Grand Slam season, he has a win and a top 10 finish. And if not for a poor putting week, I would argue, at Aronimink, he probably would have had a much better chance of winning. He didn't drive the ball particularly well on Thursday as well. That didn't hurt. But I think Rory is in for special things. But I also love the idea, and you start connecting dots here. Like, Shinnecock is just around the corner. Scottie Scheffler, we know what he can achieve there and win the career Grand Slam. So it's shaping up to be the kind of cool Grand Slam season that we all look forward to.
Look, Scotty going to have a chance at the U.S. Open. We almost came close, Rex, to John Rahm capturing the third leg of the career Grand Slam at the PGA as well. Could have gone to Birkdale trying to knock off that final leg. As it relates to Rory, it's such a difference over the past year, isn't it? Where last year it was sort of this existential crisis and he seemed sort of adrift. He didn't know what his goals and his motivation were going to be. I love the fact that he's just going for it at this point. He's brutally honest in some of his criticisms and some of his press conferences, which as a reporter, as a golf fan, I think you love to hear a superstar athlete who is actually open and transparent and able to give an honest answer. And I think physically, mentally, he's just going for it and now trying to stockpile as many major championships at this point in his career as he possibly can and not worrying about what's coming down the line. I want to go back to something that happened on Wednesday, and that was the PGA of America's annual press conference. It was the first time that we heard from Terry Clark, the new CEO of the PGA of America, in that setting. And I was struck, I was on the live from desk, I was struck by how many questions Terry Clark was asked about the PGA of America's identity. Do they miss going back to August? Would they consider moving the championship international? He could not have been, I think, more dismissive and really staking his claim to wanting the PGA in this date. And he certainly had some reasons for doing so. You know, agronomically, I think it's been a success. And we saw that this week, sort of the differentiation in the weather conditions. It was really cold. It was really warm. It was really windy. I thought the Northeast venue really showed out, just as it did a couple of years ago at Oak Hill. The variability that you can get this time of year at these sort of venues, I think, shined. It certainly works for the TV partners. It's sort of a lull in the TV and sort of the sports calendar where you have the playoffs, but it's not quite the finale and the championships. That works well, I think, as well. But I think the identity, Rex, of the PGA Championship, I think this was a good week to fortify it. And you might not have sort of the sexy branding of Glory's Last Shot, but you do have a player in Aaron Rye winning the golf tournament and a championship that's set up for the deepest and the strongest field in golf That's the PGA of America's identity. You don't need to have this glorious last shot. You don't need to throw it at the end of the golf calendar for this thing to stand out.
No, I agree. And I think I talked with Kerry Hager like 2 weeks ago about this, and he made a lot of good points about it's better now in May. And I truly believe that. And when it comes to the identity, I think that's still something that the PGA is going to struggle with. You can argue that it's the strongest field in golf, and it's not even an argument. It is statistically, it's the strongest field in golf, but I think they're still looking for something. I love the idea, and our colleague Eamon Lynch reported this earlier in the week, the idea that they're looking to events like the Australian Open, which did transform itself, turned itself into something new, something different. I think the new CEO, Terry Clark, I think has some great ideas.
That's a tennis tournament, not the golf tournament, just for those for a clarification. But yes, how do you turn something that is generally viewed as the weakest or the least prestigious of the Grand Slam events and turn it into a spectacle, turn it into something important? I couldn't agree with you more. That is sort of the model for the PGA Championship, and I'm confident that they will eventually get there. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav. As a reminder, you can go to golfchannel.com/Rex and Lav. We're going to have a brand new Live From with Rex and Lav newsletter dropping. I'm going to have plenty more on Aaron Rye's victory, some parting thoughts from the PGA Championship. Rex, you've got your notebook full of notes and nuggets from the week that you've cobbled together here at Aronimink. It's been a lot of fun. Appreciate you guys listening, tapping in with us on social media, YouTube, and the like, and commenting. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys on Wednesday as we rehash everything from the PGA Championship and look ahead to the second half of the PGA Tour season.